My name is Stephen, and I am an alcoholic. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Jackie and Debbie, have a list of such groups and their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Sandy will read the preamble. I gotta open this up to you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sandy, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Steve will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Steve Macy. I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people, wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us in the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Tiffany will read the traditions.
Hi, my name's Tiffany. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. A, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need to always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our maiden speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Samantha.
Hi, I'm Samantha. I'm an alcoholic. The tears are already starting. It's not a good sign, but... Melissa, thank you so much for asking me to speak tonight. Such an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak at an AA meeting, but truly an honor to get up in front of this group, my home group. So much love in this room. God, if you're new or you're just coming back, keep coming back. Just keep coming. You'll get it. And my only suggestion is do not leave this room tonight without a sponsor. Some really special people in this room who just really want to carry the message. In a general way, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in New York. I was around a lot of drinking when I was very young, and somehow the message was, you know, that it was just a lot, that's what you did to loosen up and have a good time, and, you know, I just looked, there was just a lot of entertaining in my family, and it looked so cool, and I just wanted to try it, and, you know, my parents definitely did let me try it a little bit, but things really took off for me when I was in sixth grade. I went to I was at an all-girls school, and I joined the drama production with the boys' school, and I started to date somebody who was in eighth grade, and basically what happened was that... I was a little too prude for him, and I found out that he, you know, cheated on me, and I didn't know how to get through the next three performances, how I was going to face him and face this girl that, you know, he cheated on me with, and two other eighth graders took me home that night, and they put some vodka in a blender with some Hawaiian punch, and that was, you know, and I felt better, and I could, you know, get through the next performances, and, you know, I was always extremely uncomfortable in my own skin. I just, you know, I always tell this story about feeling like a Josie Grossy. There's a movie with Drew Barrymore where, you know, in high school she felt Josie Grossy, and I felt Josie Grossy, but when I, you know, took alcohol in, I felt like the prom queen. You know, everybody wanted me, and I was really, you know, became popular and at ease, and, you know, the truth is I was probably never Josie Grossy, and, you know, the alcohol just had this effect, and, you know, I just knew that if I was uncomfortable or I was scared or I was angry, you know, that's what I did. I drank. And, you know, by eighth grade, I was like a real problem child. My parents were divorced, but my mother, you know, poor thing, you know, just couldn't deal with me. And their solution was, you know, let's send her away to boarding school. Maybe they can control her. And, you know, I was all for it. I knew I wasn't going to get under control because, you know, I was going to be on my own. And basically that's what happened. You know, I got progressively worse. I tried things I hadn't tried. I just, you know, I became like a, you know, like a chain smoker, and, you know, I went from being a B student to being, you know, on academic probation. All my friends were seniors, and I got in with the wrong crowd, and I got into a lot of trouble, and, you know, it was not my drinking that was the reason that I left that school in the middle of my junior year. It was actually another problem, but I believe that that problem helped me to hit a quicker bottom because I transferred to a school where I commuted to and from school. I had my driver's license, and, you know, I would miss school like 3 and 4 days at a time. In fact, I had a boyfriend who worked in a liquor store, and it just, you know, all my friends were bartenders, and I just, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm scared because, you know, I have a baby daughter now, and I think of how easy it was for me to get served in this city, and, you know, before I was even 21, I was just, you know, I was an alcoholic, and of course I thought everything else was my problem. It was because my parents were divorced, or because, you know, I didn't have a boyfriend, or I had the wrong boyfriend, or I, you know, couldn't go on this trip, you know, what it was always about, you know, something else, and I never wanted to look at myself, and the grace of God, you know, I was put into treatment during my senior year and was taken to my first AA meeting, and I'll never forget that feeling that I, you know, wasn't alone. I heard these stories and I was like, my God, you know, I'm not the only one who thinks and feels this way, and it was so comforting. And unfortunately, you know, it took me another, I guess, you know, I was 18 and I came in right before, you know, right after my 23rd birthday, so I had come back. I was in and out, you know, for like 6 years, and you know, was able to get 9 months here and 6 months here, but I, you know, I had never surrendered, and I was never ready to, you know, I was like this a la carte program. I basically, you know, wanted, you know, to do it my way, and thank God, you know, March 9th of 96, you know, I was my, you know, last drink, I hope, and, you know, I was done, and I was ready to take suggestions, and I had met Allie, and very reluctantly started coming to this group, you know, and what it was about was that you guys were all happy and giddy, and I was miserable, and I didn't think I deserved what you had, and a day at a time, a week at a time, you know, I remember my first commitment was, you know, helping, I was like alternate basket passer, and, you know, I started to fit in and go to the watches, and, you know, I just, then I became the cake girl. I mean, you know, I've had like almost every position, and service is so great, and, you know, I just, what I want to say is, you know, a lot of you know, that I, you know, became a mom almost 9 months ago, and that's been a real gift, but it's helped me to really, you know, she's almost 9 months, and I feel like how I felt when I had 9 months. You know, it's like I'm a beginner in that program, and it's helped me to use the principles I've learned in this program with her. You know, I, you know, had stopped working my steps before I had, most of you know, I had a miscarriage before I got pregnant with Dora, and I had a really big resentment, and a lot of things were going on, and, you know, you don't do a 10-step enough nights in a row, and, you know, enough resentments build up, and, you know, by the grace of God, Bonnie sat with me when I was about 8 months pregnant in the hot heat of last summer, and I had started my steps over, but we did a formal fifth step again, and, I mean, I don't, we never even counted. I think there was something like 600 resentments. I mean, I was embarrassed. I mean, I'm embarrassed saying it, but it was true. I was so angry. I was so angry. I was so scared that, you know, during that period I wasn't going to get pregnant again, and, you know, and now I, you know, I have this gift, and you know, it's been a process. I'm working on my 9-step again, and, you know, I feel very blessed. You know, one quick story that I wanted to share, like all those years that I was coming in and out, all I wanted to do was be a sponsor. Like I just wanted to get there, but I didn't want to do the work. So I couldn't understand, like, how was I going to do that? And finally, I worked through the steps with Allie, and I started to sponsor, and, you know, my sponsees would come in and out, and, you know, whatever, and 2 weeks ago, my sponsee, Olga's sponsee, celebrated a year, and I got to go to her watch, and it was so, I couldn't, you know, just to see that, you know, what Myra had been passing down to Bonnie, and Bonnie had been passing down to me, I had passed down to Olga, and she had passed down to Amy, and it was just such a miracle that, you know, I was part of that, and I just, the first thing I said to Amy when I called her on her anniversary is, you know, it's your turn, you know, you're going to take someone through, because that's what this is about, you know, it's about, you know, carrying the message, staying sober, and passing it along, and I just hope that, you know, this is the first of many people that, you know, I can continue to pass along the message and help them to carry the message, and I just want to say that, you know, I love you all, and thanks for my sobriety.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Jared.
Hi, I'm Jared, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Scott. My sobriety date is November 2nd, 2004, and I'm on step 8. I just want to say thank you to James, I guess, for letting me have the privilege to speak at my home group, and especially this group, because really, I mean, among many things, this is like, you know, absolutely saved my life. Today has been, you know, the craziest day, and it's been so different than any other day I've really had in my entire life, and I have, you know, only AA to thank, and especially, you know, the Atlantic group and all the gifts this group has given me. I was born on the Upper East Side around the corner, and I was miserable from day one. I thought that everybody was out to get me. My parents got divorced when I was, when I was young. And it was, you know, I remember that day when they called me into the room and they were like, you know, we're getting a divorce, it's not working out. And, like, I was just mad because my Nintendo broke and I was, like, throwing it against the wall and blaming, like, all this and that. I mean, I was just crazy. I always got in trouble in school. All my teachers always wrote in my report cards, you know, he's such a bright guy, but, like, something's wrong with him. Like, we don't know what is. And so I started therapy at, like, 4, and that was, like, fun, I guess. I would just talk about my mom and how terrible she was, and my father and how terrible he was, and their parents for, you know, breeding and making my parents. And I was just so angry from such a... I thought, you know, at a very early age, I was like, God had abandoned me. Like, I don't know what it was, but I was walking down the street feeling like just terrible. I thought I was so miserable. I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. When my mom got remarried, I moved to Westchester. I left Manhattan. And here, let me backtrack a little. In middle school, I went to a public middle school, which I had a big resentment about, around the corner. And I was a year younger than everyone. I had skipped kindergarten, so I was like already didn't fit in. And I started smoking cigarettes because I thought that I would be cool. And I had one cigarette and I coughed and then I got sick. And then I smoked a whole pack of cigarettes and got even sicker and then, you know, became addicted to cigarettes like within 2 days. So that's just sort of, you know, how it all started and when I was like 12. And then I had my bar mitzvah and that was crazy. I just remember, you know, being upset about some, you know, family member didn't pay enough attention to me or someone said something rude and I was just, you know, devastated and distraught. Whatever. I got drunk that night and everything was, you know, a great time from there on. Of course, I threw up and got sick and woke up that morning. I was like, I'll never drink again. That was, I think, my first drunk. I went to Mexico on a family vacation when I was like 14 and I met these older kids and like, of course, I told them I drank all the time, but I don't think I really have. And we went out to this bar and I had one drink and I just remember, you know, vividly being like, oh, I love this stuff. And then like all of a sudden, like an hour later, I was like passing out on the floor, rolling around in a foreign country. I had no idea where I was. And these kids that just met me, they were like looking at me like they didn't know what to do with me. They're like, you know, we'll take you back to the hotel because they're not going to leave me, you know, in a foreign country, which they easily could have. And so I'm walking outside. I see some girls selling bracelets. And that was the only thing I remembered from that blackout. And I gave her like $250. And I woke up the next morning. I had to fly back to New York. And I was throwing up the whole plane ride. And I was like, I'm never going to drink again. And then I went to Westchester for high school my first 2 years. And I was, you know, depressed, miserable, angry, anxious, lonely, whatever. And when I moved back to the city, I had arrived. I was 16 years old. I was going to, you know, all the nightclubs, every single party. I was going out every single night, drinking all the time. But everyone I was with drank just as much as I did. So I never really, I just thought it was because I was young, you know, when I was, you know, older, like 20, I could have one glass of wine, you know, safely. And like, I'll just tell you one thing I've always remembered. Before I even drank, I would see someone had like a glass of wine and they were sipping it slowly. And I would ask them, you know, like, why don't you chug it and like get a bottle? And they would look at me like I was crazy, you know, at 11. I was like, had braces and I was just like so curious as to why they weren't, you know, chugging the wine and ordering vodka instead of a beer. And so that's sort of how it went. I started doing, you know, crazy stuff, thank you. And I really spiraled out of control. I started missing school. I went from a straight A average to straight Fs. I failed out. I sort of start to lose all my friends, like my drinking and drugging friends. Like I lost, like they wouldn't even hang out with me. I was like stuck, you know, in my room on the street. I just did some like crazy stuff. And so I called up my mom one day and I was like, Mom, like I have a problem. I need to go to rehab. I had never really heard of AA. I just thought it was a bunch of like 9-year-old women, like drunk in a corner somewhere on the Upper East Side. Like I didn't really know what it was. So I was like, Mom, you know, I need to go to rehab. And she was like, what do you mean you need to go to rehab? Like, just eat something. And I was like, no, like, you know, like, it's not that. And so I went to rehab. I packed like I was going on a luxury vacation. And I got there, and, like, I just sort of, it didn't really hit me, you know. I went to my first AA meeting that first night, and they had, you know, put me on so much medicine to, like, help me from detoxing. So I was like, you know, this person was speaking and I was like, that was crazy. And I was just like sitting there, you know, the whole time, just not relating, just comparing. And it really, you know, didn't help me. I came back to New York. I went to an outpatient rehab center and I thought that would get me sober. I was like, oh great, Mom, you know, I'll take a few sessions and I'll get on with my life. And then I was sober for about 90 days. I didn't go to one AA meeting. I was just in rehab and I was miserable. I was so upset, and I hadn't remember relapsing one night, and I didn't tell anyone, and I was just, you know, devastated. And I still thought I can, you know, just drink on a Friday with some of my friends and, you know, come back to rehab on Monday being like, you know, put that behind me. But it was not working. I was so miserable. I was doing stuff that I never thought I would be doing, and, you know, I was so upset. So my one person that I used to always talk to, who was like my real friend, she was my hairdresser. I called her up. I had 3 days sober. I went to her house and I was like sitting there getting my hair cut, like hysterical. I don't even know what I was saying. And her personal trainer was there. And that was Alan. So he took me to my first Atlantic Group meeting and he was my sponsor. I had like 7 days. I was, you know, a nut. I looked at all you people and like, you know, but like I was smart enough to know, I was like, oh, these people, they look nice, like they're wearing nice clothes, you know, I should trust them. And so I did. And, you know, people asked me how I was and I just said good. And, you know, I was seeing the same faces every week, which is not what I was seeing in other meetings. And, you know, I got a new sponsor and, you know, we went through the big book, you know, right away, and I was working hard and I got really involved in my home group here, and I just fell in love with everyone and everything about it. And yeah, so I just want to sit here and tell you, stand here, excuse me, and tell you that if you think you're like too young to be an alcoholic, or if you're in this room and you're not really sure, the chances are if you're sitting here, like you probably are an alcoholic. Like normal people just don't end up in AA meetings. And I mean, this program has saved my life. Today, I am standing here. I graduated this morning, which I never thought was possible. Thank you. It was a year late, but I did it. And I was looking back, and I saw my grandmother at the end of the room, and she was hysterically crying. And I remember the last time I saw her hysterically crying was I was at dinner with her a year ago. And I was sitting there and my hair was falling out. Four of my teeth were fractured. And, you know, here I'm standing tonight, you know, in a suit. Like, I came here on time. I had a commitment. I did it. And I'm so grateful. And this group has saved my life. Like, I came in here with nothing, no soul, no feelings. Like, I was dead. And now I'm alive. And it's because of you people and this room and everybody in it. And I just want to say thank you so much for all your help and support. And, you know, my sobriety, and I love you all.
And our main speaker tonight is Steve.
Wow. My name's Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. This is cool. Thanks, Peggy. And Stacy, I was having one of those moments, and if you're new, and there's a lot of new people here, it's like, how did I get here? I mean, a drunk alone in his apartment for the last 5 years and then sitting here waiting to speak in New York. It's a journey you only make with a loving God and a lot of AA. Yeah. So, very grateful. I love AA. And there's a lot of people from the Pacific group here. Claire and my friend Johnny and Peggy, I know since 88, I think. So, and a lot of other friends who I've met on my wonderful journey in sobriety. I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world, and I think there's a lot of people in AA who feel that way. It's not possible. Anyway, I'll tell you what I used to be like and how I got here and what's going on with me today. I was born nervous. Worried. As a fingernail biter, bedwetter, teeth grinder, if you gave me a pencil, I ate it. I was a kid in first grade with orange on his face. Do you remember that kid? It was one just uncomfortable always. And if you see a kid like that, give him a drink, you know, save him. Save him a journey, you know. Oh, did I need a drink? I didn't know I needed a drink, but I knew what was going on was not... It felt like it was going to take a lot more work to do this thing than I had. I was overwhelmed. I had an older brother and sister. I still have an older brother and sister. And they just teased me relentlessly. I cried easily. And that's always fun to do to your little brother. I was called Mommy's Tail. Oh, I just follow Mom. They're teasing me. And my mom divorced when I was about 4 or 5. But she didn't say, we're getting divorced. We're leaving this guy. This is your new stepfather. We don't have conversations like that in my family. It was pack up. He's got more money. Stephen, shh. Contain yourself. So she married this really delightful man who was my stepfather. He had 3 sons. And my mom had us 3 kids, and they threw us all into one house, and it was, they were normal. His 3 kids were normal. And I think my stepfather spent the next 20 years just, what is with your kids? We were high strung. We were not well behaved. We needed a drink. We hadn't had any alcohol yet. He was very, very moderate up until the day he died. He just never did anything to excess. Have his couple drinks on New Year's, laugh, go to bed, go to work every day, had a wonderful sense of humor, and just poor man. And I remember, if I liked something, I got obsessed and early. I remember I got into handstands. I couldn't stop doing handstands. I'd just pop a handstand. I just, wherever we were. And then I got into bowling, and I came home one day and my thumb was bleeding. And he said, what happened to your thumb? I said, I went bowling. He said, you dropped the ball on it. No, I just bowled. He said, why is it bleeding? I don't know. He said, how many games did you bowl? I said, 25. When it bleeds, stop. Just, I don't know how to stop. And my real love, and to this day it's my love, and it was baseball. And I was a great baseball player, Jay. I just loved it. I did it well. I think I did 2 things. I was born to do 2 things in this world. One is play baseball, and the other is drink. No one had to coach me. Besides, I was uncoachable, but I just was the star pitcher, and I was really good. And at the age of 12, you move up to a higher level. You go from Little League to Pony League, and the competition's a little more stiff, and they throw the ball faster, and I got afraid. And in order to hit a baseball, you have to step towards your pitcher, and I was stepping towards my mother. This is not, at that age, the rights of manhood, and that's not a right of manhood. Mommy, get me out of here. And I gave up baseball. I gave up the thing I absolutely loved the most and did the best rather than ask for help or let you see my fear. That to me, and the rest of my life, really, even deep into sobriety, was I won't let you know how afraid I am. I thought the very best I'll ever do in this world is I'll create a persona of what I want you to see, and you'll buy it, and that'll be it. I'll never really be an authentic person. And I gave up. I picked a fight with the coach. I gave up baseball, and it seems like the day I put down my baseball mitt, I started drinking. I'm sure it wasn't the same day. Also, at this time, we were living in a place, Linwood, California, which means nothing to anybody, but we were the only Jewish family there where I felt too Jewish. And we moved to Beverly Hills, where it's like 90% Jewish, and I didn't feel Jewish enough. Can't fit in, no matter where I am. I'm the outsider. I'm enrolled ninth grade, Beverly Hills High School. It feels like everyone was born on the same day in the same hospital, and they all knew each other and went to camp with each other, and I'm the outsider, and who are you? And that's the feelings I went in, and I hooked up with another guy who just moved to town, and we went. He said, you want to go to this club up on Sunset Boulevard? And I said, okay. And we took the bus up there. We were 14-year-old ninth graders, and it was a teenage dance club, and I don't dance. To this day, I don't dance. If you see me dancing, I have a new sobriety date. And I couldn't get out of there quick enough. It was just, there were girls there, there were guys who were cool, and get me out of here. And then a week goes by, and next weekend, Greg calls, want to go back? I don't think so. He said, I have a quart of vodka. I said, I'll be right down. And there had been a little, my mother divorced. He would pick us up every 2 weeks, and my exposure, there was no drinking in my house, really, with my mom and my stepfather. And he would pick us up and take us, and on the weekend, he would take us and put us at a piano bar, and he always had a bar in his house, and I saw the bottles and stuff. And it looked very romantic. Go down to Greg's house. We pour a quart of Smirnoff, a quart of orange juice, a little Galliano on the top. Someone made a face. That's not true. It's a wonderful drink. And what alcohol did for me is I stopped biting my nails. You know, the little guy on my shoulder who's doing play-by-play and talking and never telling me I'm doing the right thing, I'm dressed wrong, I say the right thing. When I drink, he gets drunk and goes away. When I drink, I don't feel bulletproof. You look unarmed. The world becomes a friendly universe when you pour alcoholic into me. And I didn't know till I was now in AA for a while that normal people don't get that reaction to alcohol. It was absolutely magical for me. And we drank, we went, the two of us were on a bus, we were the only two people on the bus, we went to the club, and we lost each other on the way there. And I went in the club, I didn't dance, but it doesn't matter that I don't dance. I felt a part of, everyone seemed happy to see me, the new guy from out of town, and I integrated and I made friends. And my high school days were about waiting for the weekends to get drunk. I was the guy who was in charge of supply, because Al-Anons should never be in charge of supply. They could run out and not know it. I got an order. So the party's at Nancy's house. Okay, I'll call Gil Turner's liquor store, 213-651-2000. I still know their number. Order the booze, figure out how many people are going to be there, times two. Okay, we're covered. And drank, and that's what I lived for. I didn't know it was going to be the most important. It was the most important. I was a teenage alcoholic running loose in the first phase of my disease, which is the fun phase, the uninhibitor phase, the great, oh, I love you phase. And I got through high school. I became a rotten student. I was a good student, and I graduated in the lower sixth of my graduating class. just it seemed to me I had this logic that if I try really hard and get a B, that'll show them I'm a B student. So I'll just won't try at all, and I'll get an F, and they'll think I'm an A. No one thought I was an A. That logic will get you into Menlo College, which is in San Francisco, which is not hard to get into. And it was a college of 400 men. It was the only, the last year was an all-male college, and the only thing you needed to get in there was a parent who'd write a check and maybe potential. And there was about 10 people per class. We got there, we arrived there, and the first thing I did was get the phony ID. The liquor store's across the street. They had a 5-gallon water thing in our dorm room. We took the water out, put vodka in there, and I'm ready for class. And the other thing, they had a little mixer with a girls' college up there, and my friend Joey, who had also come with me to this school, he shared with me at this mixer 30 milligrams of a pill named Dexamil, which is... Dexamil is Dexedrine and Miltown. It's an amphetamine and a tranquilizer. Whoever thought of putting these two things together is Einstein brilliant. I mean, it increases your vocabulary by like 30,000 words. And you use them all in the first 12 minutes. I remember you smoke, you don't need matches because you just light one from the next. And we're at this mixer. I'll never forget this. This poor girl, if I ever see her, I'll have to make amends. I trapped her in the corner and blew smoke at her and told her everything about me for about 45 minutes. And if she didn't die from secondhand smoke, no one dies from secondhand. And I did that. But when I'm not loaded, I am restless, I'm irritable and discontent. Something's wrong. I don't fit here. And you're not loaded all the time. And I got to get out of here. There's no girls. I don't like it. I've been back to this campus sober. It's just this beautiful oak tree-laden green grass hills campus in the southern peninsula of San Francisco. But I don't like it. I got to go somewhere else. This is the problem, people, places, and things. And I fantasized and finally came upon a school that I thought might fit me. It was called World Campus Afloat. And it was a ship, and it was 100 guys and 300 girls. Those are good odds even for a shy guy, let me tell you. We left New York in the fall of 70, on this Pier 40. Funny things we remember. I love starting new stuff. A new semester and the clean notebook and the pages aren't wrinkled, and my intentions are never to screw up. I'm going to go to class. I'm going to write really legibly. I'm going to highlight in the line. I mean it. And then I just kind of poop out. I'm a 10-yard guy in a 100-yard life. You know, I'm just... Well, here's my mistake. The boat left here, and it goes to London. And they go really slow because you have to get class time in. And I'm being idealistic, and I don't... And they said no booze on board, students. So by the time I couldn't leave my cabin. I was so frightened of all the other students. And they all seemed comfortable. They all seemed like they're going through life without this guy on his shoulder. And we dock in the port of London, and I run to the pub there. I got to get rid of the feelings. I got to get rid of it. And I pour the warm, dark beer on the feelings, and then I go into town, run around, take a few pictures for my slideshow when I get back, and smuggle enough booze on. This will never happen again. I spent 6 months on board this ship drinking. And when I drink, it's still the fun phase. I'm out there. I'm making friends. I'm doing what other people seem to be doing. And I finished that. I went to a 4-year college, and I graduated in 4 years. Only because I didn't know you could make it last for 12 until I got to AA. Honest to God. I got to AA, and they go, well, yeah, I did college in 15 years. I thought, why didn't I do that? I did not want to work. My stepfather kept looking at me like, job? I mean, self-supporting is not an AA idea. I mean, my stepfather had that idea and didn't even know about AA. And I was afraid to work, talking to people, and I had no skills to work on my own. And so in my last year of college, I applied to law school, and they took me. I applied to one law school, and they took me. And I knew they'd made a mistake. I knew it. Every cell in my body knew that they meant to take my application and put it in the rejects, and somehow it got here. I mean, in the time I was in law school, the door would open. While I was in class, I knew they were going, "Is Steve Abrams here? You know you're not smart enough to be here." And that's how I started. But I'm ready. I'm prepared. I got all the cases. They give assignments in law school before school even starts. That's how serious they are. My last name is Abrams. Alphabetically, I'm screwed. It is. And the first day of law school, the contract's there. And the format is this. Abrams sits here. Contract teacher calls Steve Abrams. I stand up in front of 150 people. And what I gave these people was a panic attack. Not very macho. He tried to engage me. They asked you questions about the case, and I read the case. It was during those first 2 weeks. And he kept trying to engage me, and what was going on is my head was just whirring, and my mouth was dry, and I was sweating, and I couldn't get my brain in gear. And he was being kind, and I was being publicly humiliated. Who he got was the kid in the batter's box having a panic attack. You know, I brought that deep into AA with me. You know, and he was very kind. He gave up. I moved on to someone else, and I class ended. What I think normal people do is they go find the professor and say, you know, "I don't know what happened," or whatever. What I do is I find the nearest bar and pour alcohol on top of that. And I spent the next 2.5 years in law school not responding when they call your name and being anonymous. I understood anonymity way before I got here. And it occurred to me recently that it's like the ultimate... I was nobody. When he would call my name, I wouldn't respond. It's like the ultimate of lack of self-esteem. I didn't exist. And I got through 2 years of law school. I had 4 amphetamine doctors, and I was kind of staying below the radar. And what happened is a family friend told me he had a car dealership in Chicago, and I have no one to turn this business over to, and if you go to Chicago, the parts I heard were, "You'll be a millionaire by the time you're 30, and I'll give you a Corvette." He must have mentioned work. I never heard that. I show up, he gave me a Chevelle. But I drank. I brought the alcoholism with me, and I was in the fun and problems phase, as Father Tom talks about. It's that fun. You can't predict when you're going to drink and be happy and when you're going to drink and go inside and be depressed. And I was to fail there. I was supposed to be on the floor selling cars, and I was afraid of people. It's not a good thing to... Customers would walk in, they go, "That's your customer, Steve." And I'd go, "You can have him." And this man was the first one to say, "I'm concerned about your drinking." And it became, where it was weekends, it was more unpredictable. And I would show up to work or go out for lunch and come back with booze on my breath. And he said, "I'm really concerned about your drinking." And I was to leave Chicago. I got arrested Christmas Eve for drunk driving. And I came back to California and re-enrolled for that last year of law school to graduate and finish. And, okay, I got that out of my system, and I couldn't control and enjoy my drinking. And I'd get the bottle between my legs and drive down in California. There's a long street, Wilshire Boulevard, and I have the bottle and the glass and pour myself drinks to go to law school, to go to the university, to park in the parking lot, to pour a drink, to get the courage, to get out of the car, to go in the class, to sit down. Half the time it would work and half the time it wouldn't. And what happened to me is I got within 2 classes of graduating. I was in my last semester. They fingerprint you to take the bar, measure you for the cap and gown for the graduation service. And I was too drunk one time to show up for an exam. And they give you a grade anyway, which is unfair, but they do. They give you an F, and then your grade average drops below what you can stay in law school, and they flunk me out. And I'm not a lawyer today. Something for you to be grateful for. If you're having trouble, it ain't. I went to my first AA meeting. A girlfriend who had stayed by my side for about 6 or 7 years and said, "I'm sick of you and your drinking." I said, "I'll go to AA." And I went to AA. I had a couple drinks because I can't go anywhere without drinking. I can't be around people. I sat against the wall. I cried. I was embarrassed to be there. I felt like a failure. And a speaker said they drank. They were out of booze, so they drank mouthwash. And I thought, I've never drank mouthwash. I don't belong in AA. You know, identify, don't compare. And I wasn't done. You know, I'm a scotch drinker, not a scope drinker. I drank for another few years. Desperate, lonely, the world kept getting smaller, where I think alcohol expanded my world, and AA today expands my world. It just, I'd give up that friend who'd mentioned my drinking. I'll give up that girlfriend who's questioning this. I'll give up my parents. I'll give up my friends, because alcohol's the only solution I have. It's not a problem. It's my solution. And it was very, a lot of, don't go to the mailbox, the drapes are drawn, don't answer the phone. I remember my stepfather dropped dead suddenly at this time in my last conversation with him. We didn't look each other in the eye. He was so disappointed in how I had turned out. And how I was to go back to AA was, I went out on a blind date with a girl. And I wasn't going out. My buddy Joey set me up with this girl. I went out and date with her. She was adorable, cute, successful. And I liked her enough to not ask her out again, because I was afraid she'd say something like, what do you do? And if I was to tell the truth, I'd say, watch Jeopardy. Is that it? Pretty much. She goes, well, you have a really nice apartment. How do you pay the rent? Mommy. How's your score coming? She wrote in scores for movies, so I was just... I couldn't bear that. And apparently what happened is I called her in a blackout one night and said, I'm drunk. I can't stop drinking. I was starting to get in touch with my powerlessness and alcohol being the problem, not the solution. And she said, I'm in OA, and I'd love to take you to a meeting Sunday. And I said, okay. And she called me the next day, suspecting I may unsurrender myself. And she took me to a meeting. It was August 10th. 1980, and a guy named Sean Allen was my first speaker. He spoke in the desert. I got to see him a couple of weeks ago, and he identified. And I've been identifying. I'll be 25 August 10th, and today it's as powerful as it was then. When you share and I go, me too. I always felt alone and disconnected, and when I'm in a meeting and I go to 4 or 5 meetings a week, I need hundreds of me toos. It's my food to make me feel like there's hope for me to be. I remember at the end of my drinking, I lived in this building, it was really nice, and I'd stand, people would go off to work, and there was a jacuzzi by where they kind of file back in, and I'd get my big tumbler of scotch, and I'd stand in the jacuzzi watching these people, like, how do they do this? You know, they'd be walking back, productive lives. I thought, I can't do this. I can never be a normal person who goes off and does this. Well, I'm here to tell you, one day at a time, I am that person today, because I've swum to the middle of AA. You know, so how I stayed here. I did not get a sponsor right away. I had horrible fears about sharing from the podium. I had terror. I had panic attacks from the podium. I gave a 10-minute talk at the Pacific Group one time where my mouth was so dry it sounded like it was filled with sand. But the willingness to be embarrassed, the surrender, the willingness to be a creature of God, the willingness to not have to be the best, to just be a man among men. And how I got a sponsor, I had a little obsession early in my sobriety, and I heard people say, you know, don't get involved. And I had this obsession with this woman, and she got pregnant. And on my second AA birthday, I was sponsorless. I hadn't worked a step. I didn't have a home group. And all of a sudden, my son is born. I had this job in this travel agency. They were paying me $1,000 a month, and I put myself on commission, which isn't what non-sponsored people do. That's a decision. I went from $1,000 a month to $78.82 my first month. And all of a sudden I have this kid and I'm 2 years sober and I got a knot in my chest, and they need to baptize the son and their parents come out and he could end up in purgatory for a couple billion years. And I'm telling my mom this story, who had followed me into AA, and she said, I heard this Catholic priest share, maybe you can call him, manipulate him into baptizing Max Abrams. The Jews are on the case. I called him. He's speaking at a meeting. I met him at a meeting. And we have, you know, our sponsors, you know, they bring tears to your eyes if you, you know. They had moved a meeting into a courtyard that night, and there was just a light on the speaker. And this Catholic priest went up and shared. And I, you know, that expression, when the student's ready, the teacher appeared, and that became my teacher that night. I walked up to him after the meeting, this Jewish kid, to this Catholic priest, and said the most important thing we say around here, help. I don't want to do this alone. I'm dying. I'm not thinking about drinking, but I'm probably really close to taking a drink. And it led to my first home group, which was the White Flag Stag, where everyone shared. It was in a circle. And little by little, the first guy I sponsored, I would pick him up. And he was blind, and I would pick him up. The first time I read the big book, I read it to Jay, who was blind. And I embarked on this incredible, wonderful, exciting journey of sobriety. And I remember when I was four, I've been to New York so many times, and my girlfriend and I dated cross country for 2 years until I tricked her into moving to California. Today we went to Strawberry Fields. When I was 4 months sober, John Lennon was killed. My first feeling was, it's not possible, I'm sober. Not funny, but naive to think that it's all going to be good when I'm sober. The bad news is over. It's behind me. And things happen. People die. People get mad. Family members stop talking to us. Kids aren't all making us proud every minute. And I went there today, and it felt good. I'm excited about my life. I feel like I'm in the middle of AA. I feel like I'm willing to still be taught. I do not have all the answers. That's for sure. I talk to my sponsor a couple times a week. I'll see him in Toronto tomorrow. And I sponsor people. You know, I think it was you, Peggy, who said, you know, a lot of people who are sponsored drink, but not as many who sponsor people drink. You know, and I heard that. And I sponsor a lawyer and a bank robber. So I'm pretty covered. When my kid was being taught to swim, do you remember Julie Caffey? And she was a swimming teacher, and my little son Max was young, and he wouldn't let go of the pool to be taught how to swim. He was screaming the way kids do when they're, most kids don't go, yo, yeah, this is fun, let's drown. And she said, Max, do you want to be a rimmer or do you want to be a swimmer? You can't learn to swim holding on to the rim. And I kind of feel it's the same in AA here. You can sit in the back. You cannot work the steps. You cannot be of service. You cannot lift your chin up and see what your higher power is sending you today. But the news is the recovery's in the middle. So the saying yes to AA commitments and the reaching out and trying to find the newcomer, that's where the recovery is, and that's where the hope lives. And I've had bad days here. Trust me, I've been married and divorced. I've had my kid taken out of state against my will. I've had my mother not talk to me for a couple of years. I was to find out that guy in Chicago was my father, you know, 15 years into my sobriety. Things happen here. I have been brokenhearted. I have been giddy happy. I have never been hopeless. I have never been hopeless. You have given me hope on my darkest, loneliest day of sobriety. And may I always remember that this is where I belong. Thank you.